Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So, let's take a deep breath and relax into just a little continuation of last week's thread, and then we'll get to some emails that opened up, well, let's just say a tangle of threads, but then again, there's been quite a lot of tangles out there in the news. Let's get to something nice to know if you have hypertension, is that the recommendations, just as the cholesterol recommendations have been clarified, and in this case, the hypertension recommendations have actually been re-edited and changed back into something a little more sensible. So let's talk about the new recommendations that we've got. And the reason that this things kind of went strange on us was we were pretty solid on what we thought the blood pressure was supposed to be. We thought it was supposed to be about 140 over 90. We had good data on that, that people started to get strokes and hypertensions when it went above that. And then out in 2015, suddenly everything you knew is wrong. And for you old Fire Sign Theater fans, you'll remember that line. Since 2015, when Sprint was published, and it was a single study, it was designed to answer the question that we'd been scratching our heads about: is treatment of mild hypertension with medications warranted, and what targets should we do? So the 2015 Sprint study basically surprised everybody who was doing research in this field. It was, I think the lesson about this about face and the real teaching point is always read the method section. And when a study comes out, if the method section does not reflect the usual practice of medicine, then probably you aren't going to be able to use that data for anything useful. So we'll come back to that. But what happened is over from 2010 to 2013, Sprint enrolled 1,000 patients. And this was a group of people who had an increased risk of cardiovascular events. They could not have a history of stroke, diabetes, or symptomatic heart failure. And they couldn't already have obvious heart disease like congestive heart failure or an ejection fracture less than 35. And if their arms were too big, they were excluded. If their arms were too small, they were excluded because they wanted to get rid of people who were not compliant patients and whose arms could not be well evaluated with the standard office cuffs, because this was going to be a big study. So then what they did, they randomized these people to a trial, either blood pressure target less than 140 or less than 120. And then just like the Women's Health Initiative almost two decades earlier, the study was originally designed for 6 years. They stopped it after 2 years because the interim short-term analysis suggested, quote, potentially life-saving informations. So the authors published that you needed to prevent death from any cause or death from cardiovascular causes or a primary outcome event. They published something called the number needed to treat with this three-year trial. And what they looked at was the intervention group that was treated with more drugs to get down to 120 or less had 3.5 fewer deaths per 1,000 than the control group. Okay, so I want you to hear that. 3.5 fewer deaths per 1,000. This was a very, very big deal at the time. It would take, you'd have to treat 61 patients to prevent any kind of event, like a stroke or angina, 90 to prevent death from any cause, and you'd have to treat 172 to prevent death from cardiovascular disease. But nevertheless, The American College of Cardiology went all in and changed their recommendations for normal blood pressure. This recategorized nearly one half of the adults in the United States as hypertensive. This massive recategorization led to a lot of people getting a lot of drugs, and especially in older people, treating to this target was something that I and many of my colleagues agreed was a very, very bad idea, because our older people who were treated to 120 started fainting and passing out and breaking their hips. And, you know, that wasn't one of the outcomes in this trial. And, so it was like, well, maybe we need to go back and look at this. And when you look at it, the methodology in this SPRINT trial used ideal blood pressure techniques. I've already mentioned that the cuff size couldn't be too big or too small. They also excluded anyone who wouldn't follow instructions exactly. Well, that lets out a lot of patients, let me tell you. The protocol included sitting quietly with your feet on the floor for 5 minutes with your back supported, not talking, no disturbance or movement in the room, not smoking, no drinking coffee, and, of course, no cell phone. So if you were to do that, your blood pressure would drop. Pushing their pressures down to 120 meant that when they were wandering around in the world, they might be going up to 140 or over 90, and therefore not really a real-time difference. And so a lot of people, including the American College of Physicians and the European Cardi of Cardiology and the American College of Cardiology recently, basically revised everything back to 140 over 90. So if your blood pressure in the medical office is 140 over 90, we might put you on a diet or tell you to exercise more, and we might put you on drugs to keep it under 140 or over 90, but we're not shooting for 120 over 80 or 120 over 70. That's actually more dangerous than helpful. And the number needed to treat to prevent a heart attack, remember, in that study, 176 people to prevent one heart attack. So that's starting to look like diminishing returns to me. So we're going to roll out now with a email from Christine in Baltimore. Their subject is Tylenol. Hello, I'm an acupuncturist from San Francisco practicing in Maryland. I'm a longtime listener and a big fan of yours. Please discuss the recent statements made on Tylenol and autism. I'm inclined not to believe this administration on anything, but I also want to be fair. I'm eager to hear your analysis. Well, here's what I would have to say, and I'll bring some evidence on board, but spoiler alert, no doubt autism is up. There's some interesting reasons for that have nothing to do with the food supply, but do definitely correlate in some ways. And no doubt Tylenol is not, repeat, not the cause. So a lot of the data that RFK and Trump used to support this connection falls afoul of what we call the correlation is not equal to causation effect. Also, when the studies are evaluated, there is quite a lot of problems with the data itself. And the big one is recall bias. You know what they, in court of law, they call it a leading question, objection, the counsel is leading the witness. Well, I want to give you a scenario. So person brings in their 18-month-old or their 2-year-old for a well child check. The doctor is concerned about behavioral milestones. The child is sent off to be evaluated and is flagged as having suspicion for autism. And then someone asks the mom, well, did you ever take Tylenol during the pregnancy? You know, you run through a list of drugs. And, you know, the mom, unless she's very vehement about not taking drugs, given the recommendation, is probably going to say, yeah, I probably took Tylenol. The other thing is that because Tylenol is the only thing you can take for a fever, and pediatricians and gynecologists, obstetricians rather, tell patients, if you get a fever, take Tylenol, because the fever is causing birth defects. A maternal fever causes lots of birth defects, lots of different kinds. It's a very bad thing to have, and we always want to treat that fever. And we can't use aspirin or any of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories because of its effect on the vascular system of a fetus or an embryo. So we've got to be extraordinarily careful with all of the other alternative drugs, and we can't allow a fever. So there's a lot of Tylenol being thrown at women who get a fever. This potential recall bias is huge. An interesting study published in 2024 is called the Swedish Sibling Controlled Study. It had 2.5 million children. The fact that it has so many is super important, because when comparing siblings, where one was exposed to acetaminophen, and in Sweden they actually have that data because the government hands out the acetaminophen, so one was exposed to acetaminophen during pregnancy and one wasn't, there is no association between autism, ADHD, or intellectual disability. There's a difference in the family's behavior with respect to drugs, but they call this familial confounding. A similar Norwegian sibling control studies found that the association was absent to very loose, and it was a study that was heavily weighted towards ADHD, which doesn't tell us much about autism anyway. And really, we're worried about autism. The Boston birth cohort study was so small, only 996 children, and it didn't control for any other known genetic and environmental factors that affect autism. So yeah, there's a lot of bad science out there, and a good example of not so great science was published, I found this, was published August 14th, 2025. Interesting timing, by a group at Harvard, and it's an environmental health group, and they did a meta-analysis. So let's start with what's that. A meta-analysis was where you take a whole bunch of other studies that had different methodologies and different endpoints and different ways of scoring things. Remember what I just said about, you know, excluding all of the people with big arms in order to show that it was safe to treat down to a target of 120 for blood pressure. Well, because there's a strong association with fever and Tylenol use, there's a problem with considering Tylenol as a neutral thing. How long? Because the people who take it have something wrong with them, at least a certain percentage of them do. What the studies that they used had 27 that were positive associations, 9 that showed null, so, and 13 that showed protective effects. Now let's break that down. So that's 13 studies showing, 50% of the studies that they looked at showed protective or no significant link between, right? But 27 studies showed positive associations. And the problem there is something called positive result bias. It's very difficult to get negative research that says that there's no problem with something published. It's really, really difficult. There is a publication bias in favor of positive results, sexy results. And here's the other thing. It's been estimated that 60% of women in the United States use acetaminophen during pregnancy for headaches, pain, and fever. So is there actually a risk there? And this is where the autism is going up thing comes in. So before we get to that, I'm just going to do a little comparison with other countries. The British healthcare regulator released a statement on Tuesday That's probably last Tuesday, I think. Things are coming at us so fast. I'm not sure exactly when that Trump speech was made, but anyway, recently the British health regulator, the medicine regulator of medicines and healthcare, said paracetamol, which is what they call Tylenol in the EU, is safe and no evidence that it causes autism in children. The European Medicines Agency said the same thing. No new evidence that would require changes to their guidance. The manufacturers, of course, say it's not true. Now let's get to why I think this is garbage science. Let's take a deep breath, first of all, and go back to actual data. And what have we got? We've got really good epidemiologic data from the California Department of Developmental Services looking at autism from 1989 to April 2024. And I want to start with just giving you a little bit of data about the history of Tylenol. Okay, so Tylenol actually is developed in the 1950s and became the drug of choice to treat fever in both infants, pregnant people, and just about anybody else in the 1960s. You can look at the sales of Tylenol and utilization, and it has been pretty high from 1960 on. And here's the thing. Between 1960 and 1990, the rates of autism were totally flat. It was present in, like, depending on your definition and what data you look at, it was way under 1% of the population, fractions of a percentage point. It was rare. And then something really important happened in 1994. And that was when the DSM-4 recalculated and changed the standards for making the diagnosis of autism. And there's a couple of reasons why this is super important. And the big one is that people with lower levels of autism or mildly impairment as opposed to gravely impaired suddenly qualified for treatment at the regional centers and extra education and extra tutoring and extra resources. So there was a bump in the reporting for two reasons, one of which was, you know, the obvious one, that they redefined it. And the rates start to creep up in around 1995. And that's DSM-4. And then in 2013, the DSM-5 comes out and they reclassify. So rather than having Asperger's syndrome and mild impairment as separate categories with separate diagnostic criteria, they lump them all together. And that lumping was in 2013, and the rate of increase, the acceleration in autism diagnoses goes way up. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, there's no change in Tylenol consumption, or, you know, when you look at it on a per capita basis. So if Tylenol were the problem, we would not see these two inflection points, and we would not see between 2013 and 2024 a more than doubling of autism rates. Now, let me just give you another data-based thing. In 1988, high fructose corn syrup became the standard in cola drinks and soda drinks. And in that same period of time, between now and then, the rates of type 2 diabetes in children, previously almost unheard of, went from 2.6% to 9.4%. In other words, more than tripling. And that is another example of something I think that's really leading right into my next topic. Let's check the time. On the subject of RFK, he reminds me of Isaac Newton in that it's amazing how someone can be so right about some things and so wrong about others. In the case of Isaac Newton, he was a fabulous scientist. He basically figured out orbital mechanics. He figured out a lot of basic Newtonian physics. It's named after him because he, like, bounced billiard balls back and forth and figured out all sorts of things about friction and elastic recoil. Fundamental scientist. But also, as he got older, he got really into astrology, which, I'm sorry, astrologers, believers out there, you be you, but I don't believe in it, and I don't see any predictive scientific evidence that backs up astrology. If you have a paper with a methods section that you want to shoot me that shows that actually does anything, that isn't subjective bias, which is why we have placebos, I can think of how you might do a study like that. You might basically switch horoscopes. The person in the study wouldn't read any horoscopes but the one you gave them, and you could give them a different star sign's horoscope and have them decide over time whether that's working and having predictive value. I won't hold my breath for that. Segueing back, I want to talk about ultra-processed foods, because I am right down with RFK on the ultra-processed foods. And the book just came out. This is the work of Kevin Hall, who was a scientist at NIH, until just recently when he resigned from the NIH because the Trump administration was censoring him. Of course, they say no such thing. But he has written a new book, Food Intelligence, How the Science of Food Both Nourishes and Harms Us. I reviewed this interview. I'm going to give you a capsule version of some of his research. And it's very surprising. So Kevin Hall recruited a group of healthy adults, and he put them on two different diets. And they didn't know which diet they were on. One diet consisted mostly of homemade, unprocessed foods, like I ate growing up, fresh fruits, vegetables, nuts, whole grains, Greek yogurt, salads with grilled chicken. The other diet contained an assortment of packaged foods, and other staples of the ultra-processed diet. But the thing is, they matched these diets on calories. Nutrients like salt, sugar, fat, and fiber were all equal. So those possible contributors should have been controlled for. But what they found was that the participants consumed an extra 500 calories a day when they were on the ultra-processed diet, and they all gained weight. So it's not just how much salt, fat, sugar, and calories we put into our mouth, but how to what extent that food's undergone industrial processing. So this book, Food Intelligence, is out there. You can read it or look for a review of it. But it's not just, according to Kevin Hall, our food, but our food environment, the marketing of food, how terribly convenient, cheap, and tasty it is. And, you know, we, in the mid-20th century, we had people who were malnourished. They were calorie-starved. They were skinny. They didn't have energy. We put in place policies and incentives to mass-produce more protein and calories. At an industrial scale, this led to factory farming, but that's a different story. But right now in the United States, this figure blew me away, we grow 15,000 calories per person per day. And the food system's designed to get rid of those calories. A huge chunk of them go to animals, and you're all very well aware of the problems with global warming. We create biofuels out of corn and soy. Oops, more global warming. Just transferring carbon into the atmosphere. And we've come up with really ingenious ideas. I mentioned high fructose corn syrup earlier. This didn't exist until the middle of the 20th century when we created the corn glut, and they had to figure out something to do with it. So, well, why don't we we don't like Cuba anyway, so let's start using high fructose corn syrup. Then we won't have to buy sugar as much, and of course, the sodas back in the 80s were smaller. There was no such thing as a big gulp. It was a 8-ounce bottle. Just makes me crack up when you see those old Coke bottles. It's like, well, gee, that's just like a couple of swigs compared to the volume of soda that people consume now. This idea that people consume more calories has to do with a lot of factors. Calories per bite being a big one. Food, this palatability, foods that are hyper-palatal. You can't eat just one. That was an old ad for potato chip. But there's specific combinations of fat and sugar, fat and salt, and carbs and salt that science has actually studied, double-blind placebo and all of that, and found that these are the things that tweak our neurotransmitters. They tweak us to release dopamine that makes these food actually addictive. So Hall's group did a follow-up study where they reformulated the ultra-processed diet so that they would vary in the amount of energy-dense and hyper-palatable foods they contain. They had a diet of minimally processed foods, and they had a diet where 80% of the calories were from ultra-processed foods. But they started messing around to decrease the amounts of hyper-palatable foods. In other words, foods that had this programmed perfect ratio of fat and salt. And what they found is that people did not overconsume calories on a highly ultra-processed diet if the energy density, in other words, the density per bite, and the proportion of the hyper-palatable foods matched the minimally processed diet. So this is something that we can fix. It's a little bit like taking the red dye out of Cheerios. The Cheerios are going to look more boring and not so bright and colorful, but they'll probably be healthier. So they, since this is an interview, they went on to talk to Dr. Hall about his diet. And I'm not going to read the whole paragraph here, but they have young children, which I think is really important. And he skips breakfast, which I don't necessarily agree with, but then he has a late snack of something like fruit or nuts or eggs. And dinner, he uses a lot of marinara sauce. He puts that on vegetables. He always has a meat dish. He likes to grill up the vegetables. That improves the taste of the vegetables if you grill them. They taste sweeter because of the Maillard reaction, which is biochemistry. The kids will eat green beans, and they'll eat salmon. And they only like farm salmons. They don't like scallops, but they'll eat veggies and rice and beans. And so they get a few chicken nuggets. The parents don't, because that is an ultra, ultra processed food. But when you have children, often you're trying to get them to eat, particularly when they're really young and you're worried about their nutrition. I wouldn't be pushing the chicken nuggets if my child was already suffering from substantial obesity or already had type 2 diabetes. Getting the tastes early. And early, what's that mean? Well, it means probably by the teens. You have to get your mouth and your kid's mouth around vegetables, around fresh things, and off of stuff that comes in plastic packages that has maltodextrin or lots of fat and lots of either sugar or salt. And let's go to a caller who's just come in. Hello, you're on the air.
Evening.
Good evening. What's your name and where are you calling from?
David Santa Cruz.
Okay, David, what's up?
Well, I was talking to my doctor yesterday about healthcare 4.0 and putting RFK wanting everyone to wear bracelets that would connect them with the cloud and some of those points that, and he said, yeah, he made an offhand comment, said we'll all be cyborgs.
Oh, well, now how do you understand cyborg?
part human, part, I guess, robot, I guess. We were kind of talking about the fact that the plan is that the doctor in the future can sit in his office and read all of your biometrics. I mean, they have bracelets from MIT now that read your blood chemistry. So it's the idea is that they can send a Wi-Fi signal into your body, and they can retrieve all this information without, you know, having to leave the office, supposedly.
There's a science fiction story that I read. I'm blanking on the author, but the title was Orcs and Crake, and it's sort of a post, yet another post-apocalyptic science story. But there's this intelligent toilet that you pee into it or poop into it, and it analyzes your data, and it gives you a readout and tells you about your omics. And this book was written 10 years ago, so we've known that this was possible. And in the functional medicine circles, particularly people with lots of money to buy these gadgets, there are a lot of interesting studies going on. There's one called the Million Man Study that started about 10, at least 5 years ago, probably longer, where people are sending in blood and spit and poop and pee every month, and they are wearing a bunch of these different devices. And all that data is being analyzed. And it's a really good idea. This is all voluntary. I want to emphasize that. So people are voluntarily giving up their privacy. But the chance that we might discover, for example, that a certain chemical in urine is predictive of influenza, and that you're coming down with the flu or you're coming down with COVID before you actually have COVID or before you're contagious, this would be, just for example, really valuable. Early diagnosis of, let's say, a chemical that predicts, pick your disease, let's say cancer. There's probably a half dozen factors that are currently being looked at very seriously to see whether the combination of them is predictive that somewhere in that person's body there's a cancer that's taking root and starting to grow. And we have the technology. It's a beautiful dream, but I think we have to look very carefully at privacy and talk about illegal search and seizure. You know, your information is yours. Your preferences are yours.
Well, that's a good point, because part of this program has what's called a digital twin, which is a file that contains all this information that's collected. And there are now states, California and Colorado, that are putting out legislation which is called neural contract rights, and which says this digital twin can send information and receive it. Okay, this file. So these laws are made to say, well, advertisers can't buy permission to use your digital twin to send advertising to you, or you can't be hacked. These are actual legislations that are happening now around this digital twin, which is evidently already being collected.
Yeah, I wasn't really aware of the implications of the data collection with respect to the
thing.
But with respect to the digital twin, I do notice, and this has been going on so long, I've normalized it mentally, but I buy a lot of shoes online. So if I don't have my ad blocker on, all I get are shoe ads. You know, it's like, oh, I have enough shoes right now, you know, but aren't these pretty? You know, so somebody is reading my mail, so to speak. And I think when this got set up, I was there. I mean, I go way back. I go back before the internet. And when it started, none of us had any idea that this would be anything more than like cottage industry bulletin boards and websites that people built for themselves and, communities of interest that all wanted to, you know, talk about whatever. And it became, with social media, this just distortion of what it could have been. And you can't put the genie back in the bottle, but you can certainly close the windows in the room. And I think that's sort of where we're at right now.
Well, this digital twin is government database. This is, and which it could, would be able to sell access to companies that wanted to buy it.
Right. I understand the implications.
And what I understand is the ads could be sent directly into your head.
Not yet, but if you, all you have to do is turn your phone off, and they won't get into your head. I do think that there are people out there right now who have a chip implanted for various reasons, so they can open their door with the wave of a hand and be cool, or whatever it is. And but I think that we all have to think very carefully in about what is permissible and what isn't. Thank you for the call. I think it's a little off topic for this show, and I don't feel competent really to discuss it further.
Well, thank you for taking it that far. I was just going off of ripping off what my doctor and I talked about the other day. It was kind of hypothetical, but evidently some of that stuff is in place. RFK wants us to wear bracelets, wearables that track us. So,
well, we can just say no, to quote a famous Republican. All right. Bye-bye for now. So I see a couple of emails. I'm going to pivot over to them. And first of all, Pat writes that it was Margaret Atwood who wrote Oryx and Crake. Thank you very much, Pat. I knew someone out there would rescue me. So moving on to another email. This one from Lloyd Kelsey. And Lloyd writes, he sent me an article from The Guardian. This is really geeky, so bear with me, folks. Using the mechanical perturbation, in other words, like the vibration, from what looks like a phased array ultrasound helmet as a less invasive alternative to surgically implanted electrodes for deep brain stimulation. Okay, we've been talking about brain stimulation on this program for quite some time, plus the Elon Musk Neuralink stuff that he's been trying to build, where you actually put an electrode link on the surface of the brain. And that would allow for example, paralyzed people or people who've lost the ability to speech to interact with a computer that could fill in for the missing functionality. Truly something I might be willing to sacrifice some privacy for were I in that situation. Sort of like taking the bad chemotherapy, but, you know, you get to live, but you're going to have a really bad year. There's the current, continuing with Lloyd's message, still a bulky prototype needing an MRI machine for feedback. Company started to explore as usual, but intriguing. And I'm looking now at a picture, a side view, and it looks like somebody, this is a cutaway, so it looks like a mohawk, but really this is a helmet that's probably about, let's call it 3.5 inches bigger than the head, that sits on your head. So it's like a thick styrofoam thing. And coming out of that are a bunch of wiring that is going off to an input device. And then that is going to create sound waves. So like little microphones in the helmet that are going to beam ultrasound into across your skull and get your brain to vibrate, because, of course, the brain is fluid. It's jelly-like. Deep brain stimulation can be done electromagnetically. It can be done with magnets. It can be done with electricity. Primarily what we're using now is magnets. And we don't really quite know how to drive the vehicle yet, but there are promising data with respect to treating depression. And in the case of electrical brain stimulation, you know, the implantable leads, there's data on things like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and Tourette syndrome that are very promising. But the problem is putting that into someone's brain. Now, if we could do it with a helmet that perhaps someone could using a miniaturized version of this ultrasound device, you might be able to get that same deep brain stimulation in a fashion that would be portable. And that would be a real game changer if it could be portable. The other thing about this ultrasound array, I guess they have 256 different sources, and they're all aiming at a single thing, so they get amplification in the place they're targeting. Very similar to what we do with multi-beam radiation in cancer. Any single beam isn't going to kill the tissue it's passing through, or in the case of the ultrasound stimulation, it's not going to stimulate it. It's just going to make it, you know, give it waves. And those waves, when they concentrate at one point and sum, are going to be big enough to actually stimulate parts of the brain. Now, in the study here, you know, we're trying to get to the vagus nerve. We're trying to get to the substantia nigra, where the Parkinson's lives. This one used the visual cortex. It was all done in volunteers. And what they were trying to do was target an area in the visual cortex that they could then read on the MRI. It was an area, a tiny area, about the size of a grain of rice. And it changed visual processing, and it lasted, let's see, I don't remember how long it lasted, but it basically, the treatment lasted for a while. And that is very promising in the sense that if this technology can be further developed, we might have a helmet that people with Parkinson's disease could wear, or in the case of Alzheimer's, literally something that would wake up the memory center so that they could form new memories and they could have better recollection. And even though it would be an assistive device, like one of those walking robots for someone with a spinal injury, but it could drastically improve quality of life for something that we've hitherto really been able to treat adequately. Steve wrote, Stephen in Prunedale here, loving the show. I'm happy you're talking about dietary things here. I've got a recent diagnosis of malignant adrenal tumors, non-typical pheochromocytoma. Wonder if you've heard of a diet called the fasting mimicking diet, or FMD. If you could speak to this, it would be great. Just wondering if there might be some benefit treatment-wise. Well, Stephen, yes. And the first thing I will say about the fasting mimicking diet is tied in with something with chronotherapy. So when a person is getting chemotherapy or radiation therapy, it has been shown that if you're trying to kill a cancer, the best time to do it is when the person has been fasting and, you know, for as long as you can manage, but 12 hours would be really good. So the problem is that chemotherapy is usually going to be done when it's convenient for the chemotherapy infusion center. And so we should really be fighting over those early morning infusions, because it's the easiest way to do it. You cut off, you eat your last meal 14 hours before your chemo, and you walk in there, you're hungry, but your blood, your healthy cells have the ability to basically downshift their metabolism when there's not a good food supply. And that's just a one of the features of being a healthy cell that's got mitochondria. So you can bank some of that energy and consume it more slowly. But cancer cells, on the other hand, they don't have the ability to downshift. They have to keep growing, and they use just glycolysis. So they're burning through a lot more sugar than you do. They're getting fewer calories per carbon couplet. This is to say, you take one molecule of sugar, chop it up into three carbon couplets, and then you run that through Krebs cycle. I think, if I'm recalling correctly, you get about 8 ATP off of that. Now, in us, what happens after Krebs cycle is we take what comes out of Krebs cycle and we throw it into the mitochondria, and they chew on it, and just like a cow or my bunny can eat straw, which would just sit in my gut and get pooped out the other end unchanged, the microbiome of these other creatures allows them to digest the straw. And our mitochondria allow us to digest the leftovers from Krebs cycle and use those as food, eat up those molecular bonds. So it's incredibly useful to fast. And the fasting mimicking diet, just done on general principle, slows down the growth of cancer cells. That at least has been established. They aren't able to grow 20, you know, as much, because instead of having 14 hours or 16 hours of calories, they've only got 8 to 10 hours of calories, or whatever you can manage in terms of how much you can compress. But that figure of 14 hours of fasting prior to chemo or radiation. That one's solid in terms of improving the outcome and reducing the overall number of treatments you need because you kill the cancer off faster. I'm very sorry to hear about your diagnosis, and I hope that you are going to weather the storm of therapy for this. But I want to encourage, I want to give you hope and encouragement because we have, well, as you know, as many of the audience knows, my husband recently underwent a brand new therapy, the CAR T-cell therapy for chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy, and it has been transformational and curative. So I am celebrating the new cancer technologies between CRISPR and this microRNA stuff that we've got a whole new toolkit. It's kind of there at the invention of fire, the invention of the wheel in terms of the level of transformation this is going to have in the way that we approach health and disease. And coupled with, you know, the number of people who participate in these studies where lots and lots of things are being analyzed all the time, like our previous caller was talking about with respect to data, when you start doing that with body fluids and you turn AI loose on it and the correlations and the associations start coming out, it's really a magnificent treasure chest that we're looking at. So we have another email. This one was from Bruce, and Bruce from Seaside writes, interesting article with a link to the research. It seems to be the kind of thing you promote and why, and this fits right into the previous discussion about the hyper-processed food. This is a discussion of dietary fiber, particularly a fiber called inulin. So researchers found that inulin stimulates the breakdown of dietary fructose by small intestinal gut bacteria. And what this does is it helps with fatty liver. Because fructose, if it can't be properly digested and absorbed in the small intestine, is going to head into the liver. And we have, when fructose gets to the liver, you get something called fructose-induced hepatic de novo lipogenesis. So this helps protect the liver, and we want that. But a simple dietary change that increases fiber intake can reshape gut bacteria and protect the liver. So what's the magic fiber? It's a fiber called inulin. The dietary foods that contain the most inulin are chicory and Jerusalem artichoke, also known as sunchokes. And root vegetables in general are pretty high in inulin. And when you add inulin, you prevent fructose-induced fatty liver disease. And it also helps the liver do something else. It helps the liver make more antioxidants, which is great for preventing cancer and reducing obesity, of course, is always something on the horizon, and eating more fiber helps reduce obesity. What I would love to see would be someone engineering foods, healthy snack foods that were, for example, high in inulin. And I wish we could add fiber to beverages, since we seem to really like spending $6 on a bottle of something. But definitely keeping the gut bacteria healthy, and perhaps this is one of those metabolic things that we should be looking at, is how well how much fructose is left in the stuff coming out of the colon, because that's going to be a way of checking how well the gut bacteria is in the small intestine is clearing the fructose. So, interesting article. Thank you, Bruce. So, one last little tidbit for you. You may do it because of cultural reasons or because that's how you were raised, but a lot of people kick off their shoes at the door. Recent studies that's widely cited but probably not important, fecal bacteria such as E. coli can be cultured from the bottoms of shoes. So can C. difficile, the bacteria that causes severe diarrhea, and methicillin-resistant Staph aureus has also been found on the bottoms of shoes. My response to this research is there's probably nothing that can't be found on the bottom of shoes, depending on where those shoes have been walking. But most of our diseases come from our hands. So unless you're rubbing your hands on the bottom of your shoes, you're probably not putting yourself at any health risk. You might, if you really want to clean your shoes, you can scrub the bottoms with soap and water, but it doesn't make any difference as far as whether or not you're going to get sick. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.